Hello, everybody. I continue to this moment to be John Atack. Seems to be nothing much I can do about it. And you get that thing where somebody says, this is my oldest friend. Well, this is my oldest friend. This is Callan Slipper. Hello, Callan.
Yeah.
And we met, if memory serves me well, and I don't actually have any memory of it, we met, I think, when we were 4 years old. We certainly knew each other by the time we were 4 years old. Now, you as a child used to claim we'd known each other since we were two. I remember that.
Yeah, I remember that too. I remember the claim was that we were tiny little things. We bumped into each other when we were two. That's
Yeah.
my recollection. My recollection of a recollection, shouldn't I
Recollection
think
of
I
a
should say.
recollection. Yeah. I mean, I have a very early memory because we moved away when I was four, and we lived in Bedford in Putno. I don't even know where Putno is. I just remember the name. And you came and visited because your mum wanted to take my mum to see the movie of South Pacific.
Ah,
And
right,
that's
okay.
my second earliest memory, the night that you stayed at our house there. So there we go. And we really were the best of friends. I you know, until you were 10 and moved away, I wasn't as close to anybody else, really. We were constant companions. We had a lot of rough and tumble. We had a lot of fun. I can remember pretending to be Mick Jagger standing on the table in your nursery room, I think it was called.
Yeah, a bit of a nursery.
Yeah. So that would have been about 1963 or 64 when we were sort of 8 or 9. And I think we haven't really been very much in touch in the last 20 years, because I think we've been busy. And I think it was a mistake on my part. I must say, I'd like to have been in touch, and I'm really glad that we are again now. So our lives gradually separated through our teens. And would you like to pick up the story and tell us the story of your life? You have 2 minutes starting now.
Well, I think the story of my life kind of begins in a more clear way when I was about 13 or 14, when I decided I was going to rethink everything. I just thought I wanted to try and understand what was going on. Anyway, and how I should respond to it. And I, well, the, I remember my sort of unvarnished Callanism. The first thing that kind of came up with was I was thinking, what do I know exists? Because, I mean, the whole world could be just a big illusion. And I thought, well, at least I know that there's somebody who's having this illusion, even if it is all an illusion. Therefore, I exist. And that was like point one. Then I thought, well, what do I want? And I thought to myself, well, I want to be happy. So that gave me sort of like a second thing, a sort of a direction, let's say.
An axiomatic progression.
That was, yeah. And then the final thing was I thought to myself, well, how am I happy? And I think I must have had an attack of inspiration at this point. Anyway, I realized that what made me happy was loving other people. So that became it. I can't claim that I've been a tremendous success in all of this loving other people, but it is certainly my desire. But after that, I began having all sorts of theories about absolutely everything and kept on changing my mind and growing and changing. As part of it, as part of my rethink, I didn't believe in God or in anything like that. But I remember one day, because I had for myself a little rule, which I called admit it, which I tried to be as honest with myself as I could be, I mean, knowing that we frequently deceive ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
I realized actually in my heart of hearts, I just knew that God exists. And it was
How
like
old were you at that
at
point?
that point, probably about 15 or maybe 14.
I mean, I remember that you and your brother Jonathan had teddy bears, one of whom was called Jesus and the other of whom was called God at around that
Yes.
time. Yeah.
Well, that was earlier than that.
Was it? I remember it from kind of coming
When we were infants.
when you're infants, but I can still remember them when I visited to watch the World Cup in 1966
Oh, well,
when
they
we
still
were
have
11.
existed
So.
then. They probably still exist somewhere in the world at the moment, at least my brother's family.
How did your mum feel about you calling your teddy bears that? Because your mum was a practicing Christian, wasn't she?
I think she's just mildly amused because, I mean, basically, it was nothing to do with religion. It was to do with one-upmanship. Because Jonathan said, "My teddy's this." And I think he said, "My teddy's." I said, "My teddy's a policeman." And he said, "His teddy's a judge." Then he said, "My teddy's Jesus." I said, "My teddy's God." Then entered into the mythical universe, let's say, of what we called Nellie and Harvey game.
The Nellie and Harvey game, yeah.
Yeah, Harvey was my rabbit, and
Yeah.
the elephant, Nellie, was Jonathan's. And then, so we had two levels we could play this on Earth or in heaven. Anyway, it got more
Multiplayer,
complicated.
multi-level game, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Anyway.
So you came to the decision as a teenager that you experienced God, that you knew that God existed.
Well, yes. I'm slightly hesitant because it became a very felt experience, I have to say. And it was based in a sort of like, felt like an encounter. And it was like admitting something that was there. I mean, it came to me with the same force as, say, moral injunctions, or as I thought about it afterwards. My knowledge that I exist, or my knowledge that other people exist, or even my knowledge of the exterior universe is there. All these things are givens, and that the experience of God seemed to me to be a given, and that rather changed my way of thinking, because my
Oddly
questions
enough.
became, well, how do I relate to this, to God? And as I went on, I realized more and more how wonderful what it was that I was being drawn to. Seemed to me that that beauty shone through everything, and particularly at that stage, the beauty shone through nature, and in the arts. And at some point, I began writing gallons of probably not very good, but poetry and
Well,
stuff.
some of it was quite good actually, but there you go.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so. That was really the beginning of it. And in effect, I ended up inventing my own religion.
Did it have the word Callan in the title somewhere?
No, it didn't have any
It wasn't
title
like
at all.
Callanetics or something like that.
Nothing like that. But I think a key point for me came after I'd been to an event in Manchester, an event run by a thing called the Focolare Movement, of which I'm still a part. Which is rooted in Christianity. It's a way of living the Christian gospel and rooted in all of the churches and accepted by the mainline churches. But anyway, I mean, the thing, this is my second time at one of their events, or I should say now, one of our events. And when I came back through a series of circumstances, I just realized I wasn't half as good as I thought I was. And I realized actually that everything for me went through, was filtered through my relationship with the girlfriend of the time, with whom I was deeply in love. And it kind of distorted the relationships I had with people, put them in second level, and it was contrary to the universal love that I wanted to have. So I said to myself, why is this going on? And it suddenly dawned on me that I was empty. So I was, having all this emotional stuff, which is pretty, as a way of sort of filling up that emptiness, and also the lovely feelings that I'd have in terms of, relating to God and all that stuff. I thought, well, maybe that's all just me filling in the emptiness. And I sort of looked around, and it seemed to me that actually whole society, people running around without asking themselves the fundamental questions as to why they were there and what was going on, if they're not, what was the meaning and purpose of their lives, and so they're all kind of giving themselves almost arbitrary reasons. Even sort of things like watching telly seem to me that it's like it's just a distraction, really. Not there's anything wrong with watching telly per se, but it was a anyway, so I made another break with everything and started trying to think more clearly and understand more clearly. And I gradually began to piece together things which I realized now were elements of the what I recognized later as the Christian gospel.
And how old were you at this time?
17, I think.
Okay.
And a key point came for me when I had been at some point. I in all of this, I've been reading stuff about different religions. And I particularly liked Buddhism and very attracted by at least some forms of Hinduism, the Advaita and all the stuff. And I like reading the Upanishads. It's
Oh,
very
yeah,
beautiful.
Upanishad's incredible.
And the Bhagavad Gita and all that. So I discovered a lot of things that seemed to me to be deeply true. But I'd also thought, well, if all religions are essentially ways of coming to the same sort of goal, I may as well take the nearest religion at hand. So I started going to church. But then I began to realize that Jesus made some pretty fundamental claims about himself. And I thought, well, these are either true or false. So that became a question for me. But also, that was part of a realization that another thing that I'd been doing, sort of like rewriting of everything, was I was but like the measure of truth. And I realized it had to be the reverse. It was something bigger than me. Truth was true. And anyway, the kind of the moment of conversion happened when I remembered some of these experiences that I'd had at sort of focolare type gatherings where there was a strong sense of the presence of God among people. And I realized that all the beautiful things I found in different religions were all true, all stayed true. But in some way, they were summed up in Jesus. And he was like, as it were, to use kind of Christian language, the word that contains all the other words. So it wasn't a denial of the beautiful things I'd found, but it was a completion. I mean, there are lots of other dimensions to all of this, I have to say. But anyway, that was it. And then so I realized that the truth I had to measure up to was Jesus, the word. And that kind of very much changed my thinking because, as I say, it wasn't me then saying what was true or what wasn't true, but me trying to discover what was true through this person, through this encounter with this person, who I met both within myself, but also in the community. So that was it.
Perhaps Rip, you stop you there and reflect a little, because our lives have run in parallel to some extent, so that I too, at the age of about 14, I can remember going, I want to know the truth. And even if the truth is upsetting, I want to know the truth. I don't want to pretend. And not that long before I'd put aside the idea of the Christian God as represented to me by my school, and particularly by my religious instruction teacher, who, when asked, can only Methodists, he was a Methodist, can only Methodists go to heaven? He, without pause, said, yes, only the Methodist, which in a Church of England school was a bit strange. And the
Methodist
next
is not
week,
an idea.
it isn't it? Isn't it? But he was an odd man. And the next week, I said to him, do you think that God can ever forgive the devil? And he said, no. Didn't stop and think. And there was just something in that. There was something of, that I saw this representation of a sort of a brutal God, a God who wanted to be worshipped, which I think is a very untrue picture. And somehow I stopped believing that. And I then, over the next several years, I particularly remember reading the Symposium by Plato, the Crito, the Phaedrus, the last speech of Socrates. And then at 17, I read the Tao Te Ching, and where you would have, and we did talk a little bit at that time in our lives, but not much. So for me, it was the realization of the Tao, you know, not a personified force or God, you know, but something perhaps akin to what Meister Eckhart called the ground out of which God, the Godhead, proceed, that there is something, this beauty that you saw in the world, I too was seeing this, but was seeing it in a different way. I'd also like to put in something about the Focolare, which is, if I remember rightly, the Focolare formed in the Second World War in the bomb shelters in Italy, and was a movement of women who were saying, we just want to live a Christian life. We don't want all of this talk about it and all of this, you meant to do this. We want to be, we want the experience of being Christian. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what you met. So let's pick you up again somewhere around about 17, 18.
Yeah, if I may just make a comment on the Tao. Yeah. I also have a deep love for the Tao Te Ching. It seems to me that the Tao, in a sense, is kind of equivalent, well, it's not exactly the same, to the word, to the logos.
Yeah.
As were the truth behind things. You also see that in sort of like ideas of law, Rita, in Hinduism or Hindu thought. So that kind of mediatory principle, let's say, seems to me to be a constant in human thought and in human attempts to understand the encounter with what I would call the divine. Anyway, so what was your question? I just wanted to pick that up because I thought that was a lovely parallel. And you know, my later studies were on Buddhism and Christianity, you know, particularly Zen Buddhism, which was very affected by Taoism.
And of course, while you were off to university and ultimately studying, you did a PhD in comparative religion, where I believe you compared Christian mystical experience with mystical experience of Zen Buddhism.
That's right.
I'd still love to see the dissertation. It's a long time since I last asked you for it. But while you were doing that, I had gone to Throstlehold Priory to become a Zen Buddhist. And I went there with the plan of being there for 6 months. This was the first actual Zen monastery opened in the UK. I have serious doubts now about that particular congregation and its founder, G.U. Kennett, because in my world, I've dealt with people who've been badly affected by their experience with it. But I lasted 3 days because the experience was so explosive, you know, learning Zazen meditation. I had a very profound experience. And I think I made very much the right decision, which was to leave. Not because I was disappointed, though I didn't like getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and only having cold water to wash in. And, you know, I'm a night owl, so I cannot sleep at that time. But the experience had been so profound that I needed to integrate it. And it remains an absolutely positive experience that I had, because during meditation, I realized that there were layers of linguistic thought. So this whole idea of you've got this unconscious mind that's doing these things. No, you've got a mind that you are not conscious of, or you've got processes in your mind that you're not conscious of. There's not an internal agent, your unconscious mind, that's plotting against you in the kind of Freudian, you know, id sort of way. And it was that was an incredible realization, because it was also a separation of linguistic and non-linguistic thought. I got to the point where I could see four levels of thought going on at the same time. And the deepest of them, which really shocked me, was a tip of the tongue phenomenon from about 2 weeks before. I was still trying to find out that word that I couldn't find. And that process was continuing inside me. And to realize that, you know, that was a different way of seeing the world and of seeing myself. I was 18 at the time. So, and I practiced, you know, meditation for a year, and then sadly, after a distressing romantic episode, fell into Scientology. But I was never a living member of Scientology, so my experience was really not that hard. And I continued with all of the reading and thinking that came from Taoism and from Buddhism throughout that period too. But so we were to some extent traveling on parallel tracks, and we were certainly, I think, looking for the same thing. We were not looking for material gain. You know, that was the thing that at school had really bothered me, that I was being told that we had to follow the example of Christ and make a great deal of money. And there's this passage, you know, you can worship God or mammon, you can worship God or money. And I fear, you know, that every compromise that can be made to worship mammon is made in our society.
Well, I've achieved not making a great deal of money, at least.
Yes, we are the winners.
Yeah. So yes, I mean, there was certain sort of parallelism there. Yeah, but I mean, your stuff with Taoism, that pursued you, as it were, the whole time. That was really a fascination. Also, when you were doing Scientology.
Yeah, and I mean, I've published two versions of the Tao Te Ching. Yeah. One the year I left Scientology in 1984, nearly said 1884. There's a Freudian slip. And which is dreadful. It's truly dreadful. But it shows me how I was thinking at that time. And then in 2005, I spent a couple of years going character by character through the best text I could find. And I read about 60 translations and about 50 commentaries to try and say, look, let's get rid of the paper tigers and straw dogs. Let's have something that's in contemporary English that tries to look at what is being said here. And to me, what is being said is largely straightforward. You know, that the universe must have begun somehow. I don't know how it began. I will call that Tao, you know, and we'll work our way out from there. And it's also not meant that I agree with everything that's being said. There's a line about the Tao is ruthless. It knows everyone dies. So the wise are ruthless. They know everyone dies. And it's that ruthless bit that I don't want to elevate ruthlessness in any way as a positive. So
is that not perhaps a problem with the translation?
Oh, always. Or it could be in the original. It could very much be that this is an imperfect work.
Language is always not quite up to the task, isn't it?
No, and as I say, 60 translations.
Beautiful as it is.
Yeah. So I was trying to point people, and for me, the value of the text, I think the Hebrew word is peshar, that where you come to something and you interpret it. You say, how is this relevant to me? And what do I think about it? Rather than, this is a law I have to follow. Something like that. And that's always been, and subsequently I became absolutely immersed in Jiangsu as well. And probably now would prefer him, this kind of Epicurean stoicism that he represents. But yeah, and I too read the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the standard so-called,
things that are lovely stuff.
It is. And there, for me, I'm a big fan of Angus Graham, who was a sinologist, who said, you know, there is this idea of the perennial philosophy that all religions have the same origin, but it is also necessary to see how much they differ and to say, you know, and we're looking for the best way to live our lives, you know, and to make something of who we are and to be part of something. And to find the truth.
Whatever that might be.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever that might be.
Or rather, what we might mean by that. Mm. That which is the case.
Yeah.
Not a bad definition. I had a lovely experience on with Buddhism, with Buddhists, let's say, where I realized some of the gifts that the various ways of understanding reality can be to one another. I was in Chiang Mai in Thailand, It was a conference that we had between a bunch of Christians and a bunch of Buddhists. These were Theravada Buddhists.
Yep.
So as a matter of just proper behavior or whatever, or courtesy, we went first of all to the invitation of the Buddhists to a meditation session, and we all quietened ourselves down, and I felt God coming to me as one does. And then, well, after that, it was so uncomfortable. I was no longer used to sitting cross-legged on the floor. I didn't go the next day. And we kind of had a
very Taoist attitude towards meditation. I don't feel like it.
Well, not that. I mean, it's just that, I mean, I did meditate on my own, on my own behalf, let's say, but not sitting down cross-legged on the floor.
Yes.
Anyway, but that's not relevant. I think, well, the relevance of it was pretty uncomfortable. There were other things to do. But then we heard, we got the impression that, because everybody had gone through a similar process, I think, thought process, you know, this is all right, we've done our bit now. we're quite happy with our own forms of spiritual practice. Anyway, we got the impression that they were might have felt a bit hurt by our not, because none of the Christians turned up the next time. Anyway, they said, you know, the Grand Master's coming along next time, and he was going to lead us in the meditation. We all thought we ought to go anyway. It's just a matter of charity, kindness, whatever. We were not wanting to be superior or anything like that. And it was a beautiful meditation. And as he was leading us through it, he was getting us to connect with all that was going on within, and to recognize that it was impermanent, to recognize there was no way of grasping it. And so there was no sort of central core to it. And to recognize that all of it had an element that was unsatisfactory. So I kind of recognized what this was, is the three signs of being. And then he said we can see how all of this opens us up to an understanding, which, how did he put it? You can see reflected upon in Jesus upon the cross, who suffered, who everything was impermanent, who lost himself. And I thought, this is very, very interesting, because I realized what would seem to me what was going on is that the technique of meditation as he was teaching it was by attentiveness to what is happening to us within the person, the human person, to open us up to an understanding of what is the nature of all things. And I think, well, I would agree with that nature of all things. My experience as a Christian doesn't deny that at all. And I feel deeply enriched by that deeper understanding. But my experience is of a divine who comes, of a God who cares. And that's the sort of Judeo-Christian thing, of a God who uncomfortably intervenes, and then we can't explain quite how it's happening. Right. So you get all the sort of the arguments about whether God exists, how can God exist, how is he going to... We're just trying to cope with the phenomenology of the experience that there is a God who turns up and makes a difference. Anyway, so it seemed to me that they're not necessarily contradictory to one another, these two things, because in the Christian experience, it's mostly about grace,
yep,
about response to a gift given. Whereas in Buddhism, there's kind of like this stripping away so that you're more attentive to what's real. And, I'm not wanting to force things on any body in all of this, and say, because I could be mistaken. However, it does seem to me that these are mutually compatible gifts. And so I don't find my sort of my Christianity, as it were, troubled by the beautiful things I discover elsewhere, although I know that I always have a lot to learn, basically, from everybody. And it seems to me that that is, as it were, a truthful stance, at least an attempt at a truthful stance, because that which is the case, going back to my original thing, is not me. So I can, through other people, I can also learn more of what is the case without denying the things that seem to me to be true, or grasps me, I should say, better.
My brother Jamie, who you will remember, my lovely brother Jamie, he, well, quite some time ago, 15 years or so back, read Richard Dawkins, and for a year or two was, quite conversational about that, let's say. My position, I'm an agnostic. It's a really safe and comfortable position. I don't feel the need to take up arms against God and declare myself an atheist. As Dawkins himself said, it seems strange to say this is something I don't believe in rather than this is something I do believe in. He did, of course, want atheists to wear t-shirts with a red letter A on them, and he quite evidently hadn't read Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, which is like all declaring that they're adulterers, but along with Hester Prynne. But it was very interesting. We had many interesting conversations, and of course there was the force of the newly converted for him, that he'd come to these ideas, and they were important ideas. And I, on the other hand, was not very impressed with Richard Dawkins. He didn't These didn't seem to me to be the cogent arguments in this area. But after a couple of years, Jamie came to something which I thought was very impressive, which was somebody was describing their religious belief, and he went, "Well, that's their metaphor. That's their way of understanding the world, making sense of it." And just as you say with the language of the Tao Te Ching, that how any one of us interprets our belief and how we state it and what we are experiencing in truth. So when you look at meditation, it's essential to work I've done for decades. I have profound problems with the mindfulness movement, and I've spoken out about this. Firstly, because for some people, meditation is quite damaging. And, there's Willoughby Britton at Brown University, who's a excuse me, a mindfulness practitioner and an assistant professor, who's put up a very good website saying, things can go wrong. You can get relaxation-induced anxiety, for example. The most nervous person I've ever met was a transcendental meditator, who'd was fixed into doing this thing. And the idea, which we mentioned when we talked a couple of weeks ago, that Jon Kabat-Zinn and Daniel Goleman have put forward, that through meditation, that's all you need, that one of one path of the Eightfold Path of Buddhism, all you need to do is meditate and you will become compassionate. And when New Scientist were promoting this idea, New Scientist, going on about how brilliant mindfulness is, with very little in the way of scientific study of this subject, frankly. Miguel Farias at Oxford, I think his students collected 3,000 studies, and they found that only 30 of them had scientific validity. That they're not really studies, they're just people who want to say that something works. But there are rare occasions where somebody has had a psychotic experience, somebody who's never had a psychotic experience through meditating. And there is a thing with many of the techniques that are used by authoritarian cult groups and non-authoritarian cult groups, where you are actually stimulating a physiological response. So, for example, if you don't eat, there will be a physiological response. If you don't sleep, there'll be a physio. And if you stare fixedly, you will get what's called the Ganzfeld effect, where there'll be hallucination because the brain is filling in because there isn't enough stimulation. And sometimes physiological effects become confused with transcendent effects, and which is not in any way to deny transcendence. That's not where I am. I'm an agnostic. I don't have to believe anything. It's very comfortable. Means when people throw things at me, I'm not there usually. But it is, I think it's very important to express that and to say that, and I think it's, this is directly relevant, that it's the way you and I behave that is the relevance of what we believe. You know, so it wasn't Voltaire who said it. It's always accredited to him. People who believe absurdities may commit atrocities. It was clearly put that way by the second premier of India. But I am, that is an essential theme for me, that we have to honestly bring together what we believe, how we perceive the universe, and in the modest and humble fashion in which you have done this in this conversation, that this is what you believe. And this has proved to be useful to you. It's given you a life of internal struggle, inevitably. We all have that life. But it's also brought you a sense of peace, yes? Brought you a sense of harmony in the world.
Yeah. There's, of course, no logical connection between the fact that my beliefs are necessarily partial, because I'm partial, yeah, and I don't know everything, and yeah, saying that these are merely relative. It is at least possible that I'm opening up to something that is absolutely true.
Yes. That's yes. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
So in my understanding of transcendence, which I do believe to be the case, I also recognize that everything I think about God may have its truth, but I don't grasp fully what it means. So let me explain what I mean by that. I believe that God is love, but I'm not sure I fully understand that love. Rather, I'm sure I don't fully understand it. For me, as a Christian, it is therefore explicated in the death of Jesus on the cross. That's complete self-giving, and that almost, well, that crazy, that wild delight in self-giving, which seems to me that right at the heart of who God is, at least as I understand him. But there's so many implications of all of that that I only grasp some of them, and I can only grasp some of them. So any perception of what may be absolute is of itself going to be relative, but it doesn't mean that the absolute is relative. It does mean that I'm then in the happy position that I can always learn, and I don't have to deny any of the things that have convinced me as being the case. I have ultimately only a few things that I think that I really would hold to, but they actually give me quite a lot. They give me a whole code, a life code. They give me a way of relating to God. And so I believe that God is, and I believe that God is love. And I believe that love is expressed in Jesus and all those things. So I'm very happy with that. But to come back to Richard Dawkins, I kind of like listening to Richard Dawkins. Because some of the things he knocks, they're fair enough. They should be knocked.
Yeah,
some of course, the yeah. times he's embarrassingly ignorant.
Well, for example, he introduced, and it was before 9/11, but he introduced one of his TV series by saying that suicide bombers were always performing a religious act. And at that time, we actually had a register. There had been about 900 recorded. And we're not talking about the kamikazes in World War II. We are talking about instances at post-war. But there were about 900 of these, and fully half of them were secular.
Yeah.
So even the
Yeah.
Al-Aqsa brigades, for example, in Israel, Palestine,
Yeah.
are secular. They're not part of some fanatical Muslim group. They'd just like somewhere to live, you know.
Yeah.
So sometimes he makes attributions, and he seemed, I think the thing that bothered me was he seemed ignorant of the history of religion or fundamental principles of theology. And
Yes,
I
he would.
think
Yeah,
when
that's true.
Stephen,
And I think,
sorry, go
but I
ahead.
think probably if you to speak up for him there, his ignorance of theology, which I find embarrassing, is because he doesn't actually really believe it's a real subject. It's people sort of dancing around fancy ideas about non-entities and non-things that don't exist. And so it's probably hard for him to muster the energy to take this thing seriously. The trouble is then that what he then knocks is not the thing that the rest of us believe in. And it's quite a common point. You know, the God he doesn't believe in, I don't believe in either. So yeah. But I mean, I do find him fun and useful and challenging. And he sometimes does say things that are sort of a bit unsettling. You have to think about more, which is always a good thing, I find.
Yes.
That helps me to understand at least a little bit more. So yeah, don't be too harsh on him because he's
And it's an important part of intellectual discovery that science functions not by being a belief system, hopefully, though all too often it does fall into that, but it's a method, it's a way of being able to constantly challenge ideas and reformulate what the evidence means. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable approach to our spiritual lives as well, that we should be questing and looking for different perspectives. And we certainly shouldn't be enforcing our beliefs upon other people, save where those beliefs are for the protection and preservation of other people. So my beliefs about, you know, not hurting people, I can see them enshrined in law as a good idea that people should not be hurt.
I agree with that. One of the things that also strikes me as mildly amusing sometimes is the picture of many atheists, and this is one of Dawkins' arguments, is of religions as all being in competition with one another, and therefore they're purely relative to where you are in your time and space. So you choose that one because that's the one you're there, but there's nothing really absolute about it because and the funny thing is that it seems as if science then is supposed to be this body of unitary perception and fact. There's no recognition that there are lots of schools in science and all the rest of it. So why can't these religions be, in fact, different versions of coming to the same sort of grappling with the same things? I mean, that's actually an oversimplification of what I believe is going on in religions, but it is dealing with certain things in terms of a fundamental level, at a fundamental level, questions about how we can live and what is the good life and what, and as I put it before, what's really going on. And they're bound to be culturally rooted because that's the only way human beings can think. But it doesn't mean that they're all contradictory. Or there's nothing to learn from all of them, and that none of them have any truth content. All of that is just, it doesn't follow from the multiplicity and the variety. This is not to say that there is no truth or no ultimate transcendence or any of these things, but it is to say that we have to recognize the gift that there is in all the variety. And listen to what's going on and what is the experience of the different people, and then different people, different cultures, and then find a deeper understanding from that. And if my fundamental belief in Christ is true, then I will be discovering more of Christ in all of that. So I'm not frightened of it, and I'm not even closed, and I don't have to be. And another person from another religion doesn't have to be closed, but I do think what we really need is a profound conversation that is really ready to listen to one another and to appreciate the gifts that there are in one another. So the other thing I want to add to that is that I mean, science is, well, science isn't just one thing. There are lots of sciences, they are one way of knowing. They're not the only way by any manner of means. And to have sort of an absolutist idea of science, a sort of scientism, that seems to me to be very unfortunate, because you know, the way we know the most powerful things in our lives are not by scientific means. When you fall in love, you won't do a scientific experiment to see whether you love the person that you love, or, you know, so that's a whole other order. And it's a more important kind of knowledge, or at least it's an extremely important, but it's vital to your life. When you see beauty, you don't do scientific experiments. You can do scientific experiments with all these, but they won't actually tell you anything about the substance of what you're knowing or what you're experiencing. So the idea that we can reduce all knowing just to one methodology seems to me to be very unfortunate. And this is not to deny the power and also the beauty of science. I mean, I love all that stuff. And I love reading about particle physics and all that stuff. Not that I claim to understand a huge amount, but I do read a bit. And I mean, I just, you know, quantum entanglement and all these sorts of things, it's just fascinating. And the way they violate my normal experience seems to me to be great fun.
Absolutely, it is. I couldn't agree more. And I've spent my life trying to understand fundamental ideas in science. I can't say that I do, but I keep trying. Stephen Jay Gould, in his response, or one of his responses, because he didn't rate Dawkins as a biologist either, but he put forward the idea that Gould was failing to see that there are distinct, what he called magisteria, and that there is the magisterium of scientific inquiry, and there is the magisterium of spiritual experience, and that these, I would say, actually, the Dai Chi, what people call the yin yang, says something about this, that because of the dot of white in the black and the dot of white in the black and the sense of movement, that some things which were presumed to be qualia, just qualities, we can actually find out about. We're finding out more and more about how the human brain works, though I can't say that I'm overwhelmingly impressed, having spent 40 years now reading books about the brain. And every one of them says, in the last 10 years, we found out more about the brain. And of course, last year, we had three mighty blows in meta-analysis: serotonin, oxytocin, and melatonin. All fell under meta-analysis of, you know, a huge amount of studies out there to say, we don't really know what these are doing. So this precision that we've been being taught about this, some of it is still guesswork. But having said that, I mean, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which I read when I was about 20 or something, where you've got this simple argument: there are qualities and quantities. And for qualities, we can go to Plato, and for quantities, we can go to Aristotle. And science is the measurement of quantities. And then there is the qualia. And of course, the hard problem of consciousness, as it's put, we haven't got close to yet. That we don't understand how consciousness functions. So there is still a great deal that is presumed, and we may find the Dai Chi will move, and that which seemed to be magic can be shown to be science. But also that which seemed to be science can be shown to be magic. It keeps on moving. And so the whole discussion of what is science and what can we prove and what can we find out, but also what is our own experience. For me, there were certain fundamental ideas, the notion of purpose or motivation in the universe. I have no sense of that. I don't believe that I'm inspired by a purpose to do something. And I don't seek purpose. I also believe that I can only get to the edge of human meaning. No matter how smart I get, it will be within the context of human meaning. And so if God there is, or if Tao there is, or Ma'at, or, you know, Buddha mind, or whatever we want to call this, it is beyond my comprehension. Again, back to Eckhart, anything that can be said about God will not be true.
Well, it'd be limited.
Exactly. Yeah. It can't be fully true. So,
I'm very happy with that. I mean, that God is beyond my full comprehension.
Yeah. It'd be too scary. You know, I'm just this tiny little thing. The universe is quite big. But, yeah. So And you've lived a fascinating life. I mean, you've done some very interesting things. Tell us a little bit about, you gave up a job a couple of years ago, yeah? Tell us a little bit about that.
When I gave up. In order to explain why I was so keen on it, I have to give a little bit of backstory.
That's good.
So the job itself was, I was working for Christian ecumenism. That's the reconciliation of all the different kinds of Christianity on behalf of the Church of England, which is my church, the church of which I'm a priest. Let's do the Church of England bit first.
Yes.
When I first began to deepen my spiritual life following the person of Jesus, it was in the context, as I mentioned before, of the Focolare movement, which is fundamentally a Roman Catholic movement, but has people of all different churches who are part of it, and actually people of different religions and even non-believers, all fascinated by this kind of unity, which is a living unity based on mutual love, that as we understand it, is what's the heart of the gospel. Well, actually, Jesus says it, you know, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. So he's giving the definition of his own death there. And he prayed night before he died that all may be one, that we might share in his unity with God, that they may be one as you and I are one. So that's, it's kind of like, that's the framework of a discovery of a living Christianity that's about relationships, about meeting God via relationships, not just in the depths of my own being, but in the encounter with other people. But as part of that, I then had the question, well, which church? And I don't need to go through all of the different permutations. I've come to, it seems to me anyway, that there is only one church. We're all part of the one movement towards God in response to God's movement to us. From a Christian perspective, we the sign of entering into that, which is an effective sign, is baptism. Not all Christians, though, are baptized. We have the Salvation Army and the Quakers, who are clearly in deep relationship with God. And as I often say, if you read the Psalms, you can see a person who has a profound relationship with God, but that person was not baptized. So the category of baptism is more than just the baptism by water. But anyway, we're all of us in solidarity in our attempts to respond to God. So my answer then is that, where am I supposed to be in all of this? And I'm very happy to be within the Anglican Communion. Yeah. And I felt that I was being called, actually, being asked to remain where I was, not hop from one church to the other, because ultimately there is the one body of Christ that we're all part of, or have all entered into. But the divisions that are real, historic, still remain. So I felt both an affirmation of that I should stay where I already was in the church I'd grown up in, and also the desire to work for the healing of this, of the communion of the body. So when I began to understand more about the Anglican Communion, and specifically the Church of England within it, I began to appreciate it more. I realized some of the gifts that were there, some of the beautiful things, a sort of pastoral sense, a freedom to think, and the ability to, or the beauty of the sacraments, and a discipline that is not harsh, but is real, if I wish to take it on. So lots of things that I found very, very comfortable and very that affirmed what I, the beauty, let's say, of the Church of England. Yeah. So that's one thing. So I was keen on my own church, but not in any way to the exclusion of others. But I was also keen upon healing the divisions. So when the possibility came up to take this job, I was very happy to do it because A, it's Church of England, B, it's all churches, or all Christians, let's say. Not all are happy with the term church for themselves. Most of them are. And that gave me the delight, really, of knowing my fellow Christians and building up lovely relationships with them. And quite apart, contrary to the idea that often seems to be portrayed, which sadly was true, as a Christians constantly each other's throats, this is absolutely not the case. At all levels, internationally, nationally, regionally, and locally, on the whole, Christians get on very well with one another. And we have just lovely relationships. During the lockdown, my friends and I, so the other sort of national level ecumenical officers, as we were called.
So you were representing the Church of England.
That's right. So we would meet, partly just because we liked being in each other's company. We'd meet on Zoom, of course. That's just one example. That deep and lovely fellowship. It did seem to me that if we'd just been there 3 weeks and the opportunity, we probably sorted out the problem of Christian unity. But anyway, that's not the situation we're in. We're in a historic situation, which has its own proper dynamics and questions of psychology, as well as all the questions of theology and organization, etc. So, but a huge amount has been done in that. So for me, that was a huge privilege to work at the national level, and then also to get to know, well, to work with the bishops and the archbishops. It was all fascinating. And then as an English person, it is so cool to do stuff that is both church and state. Wander around the Houses of Parliament. We had a group of Pentecostals who came over. So the Archbishop of Canterbury and me, the Archbishop of Canterbury, gave them a tour of Parliament. Now, I probably got more out of it than they did. It's fascinating to see these historic things. And yeah, I worked in the last year or so from Lambeth Palace. And to be near where the Book of Common Prayer was written and stuff like that, I was just liked it. So it was very satisfying at all sorts of different levels, because everything I did was building deeper relationships, a deeper unity, which I think is really what we need in the world. And you basically have to start from the particular. So the particular that I was working from was what I would understand to be very central and very core to it, and that's unity within the body of Christ. And everything I did, whether it was sort of giving advice or writing constitutions or entering into dialogues with other churches, all of it built unity. So I gave it up eventually, not quite 2 years ago now, because I've been feeling for a while that the real need for Christian ecumenism is for a deeper theological understanding and a deeper vision. And I wanted to have the freedom to pursue that a bit more, because Christian ecumenism, while it is a lovely thing, and all the churches and all the church leaders pretty much will say wonderful things about it, about the need to deepen unity among us, there aren't many resources given to it.
No.
It's kind of an add-on thing. So while the relationship has definitely grown, and we're no longer in the appallingly anti-gospel position that we used to be, contrary to the message we want to be saying, of trying to do each other down, it's quite the opposite is true. While all of that's there, the relational stuff, and that needs to grow still more, there's just not much energy at the moment, as I read it, in some of the more structural things. There is some, but there isn't as much as there could be. So why is that? And I think the problem is that the vision isn't there, and that the core of the vision is about understanding, so theology. And that's the focus of what I'm trying to do at the moment, to build the vision in cooperation with others. But so I'm now I was asked, I didn't even try to do this, but anyway, I was asked to become the chair of a thing called the Society for Ecumenical Studies, and that fits suits very well because it has a mission really to stimulate that sort of like that thinking side of things. I'm not wanting to say that's the only thing we need to do at all, but it is kind of a key thread, let's say.
Yeah,
So.
and we can only focus on one thing at a time. If we're to do something properly, then we have to focus on that element, trying to take in everything. But of course, in my 40 years of my life, where I've been dealing with authoritarian cults, essentially with Scientology, but I've dealt with people from many, many groups. Some of them regarded publicly as negative, like the Moonies or the Rajneeshis, the Krishnas, who have sort of gained a certain acceptance. I mean, this country, I believe the Hindu Council is led by the Krishna Consciousness Society, which to me is deeply worrying, understanding that also the big Arcturus Press, the biggest right-wing neo-Nazi press in the world, was formed within the Krishna temple by two monks. And we start, there are these points where fanaticism in belief starts to affect the society around in a negative way. I would particularly look to the megachurch movement in the United States, where in prosperity Christianity, these ideas which have swept up millions of people, who are, I think, pointed in the wrong direction. That we've, going back, the scandals every decade sees it. Jim Baker, somebody or other who is exploiting people. My default term is authoritarian.
Yeah, well, that's a fine way of talking.
For a long time, in my field, the term totalitarian or totalist was used, and about 5 or 6 years ago, I started a conversation that sort of said, well, total authoritarianism, the meaning of totalitarianism, is a dreadful thing, but authoritarianism in and of itself is a bad thing. I look to that, and I look to the predatory nature of some human beings. And so in some groups, I mean, recently the BBC have run some documentaries about TB Joshua in Nigeria, and the horrors of this group, the awful things that this man did. And because I've had 20 years of dealing, I have a friend who's been dealing with the casualties of that specific movement, you'll sometimes see a movement grow up that begins with a predatory determination. And maybe with power, there is this thing that there was a German historian whose name I forget, who pretty much said that people either feel the power of love or the love of power. And that it may be that the people who get into power are very often driven by that. I've had this peculiar meditation. I started working on a book on American presidents of the 20th century 30 years ago, and I gave up because I found out so much that I didn't like about these people. And I sort of thought, well, who's going to buy this book? Americans are going to attack me. The British couldn't care less. But it started a quest to see, again, my dear brother Jamie put forward the view to me many years ago that to be a successful politician or leader, you have to be Machiavellian. And I hate that thought. And so I started looking through history and going, well, who's good? And you get people like, say, King Alfred or what have you, and then you find out some of the horrific things he did. A little bit of eye gouging on the side for fun. And ultimately, there seem to be very few people, but I think that there is a possibility of power. Maybe Solon the Archon in 600 BC, as he settles the problems of Athens and then walks away. Or George Washington, when he, for 2 years, didn't want to lead America and didn't have slaves' teeth in his mouth, you know, at that time, who knows? The only politician I could find in the 20th century who really seemed to me to exemplify a person who was not selfish, grasping, and destructive was Neville Chamberlain, which kind of goes against the popular view of Neville Chamberlain. But he was somebody who did what he did based on rationality and for the public good. He rearmed Britain in 1935. He insisted on building fighter aircraft. And at Munich, where he appeased Hitler, he knew that there were only 12 high-altitude fighter planes in the Royal Air Force, 12 Hawker Hurricanes. So we would have been wiped out if war had been declared. And yet, courtesy of, in fact, the Labour Party and Michael Foote in particular, he became the guilty man, the man who had somehow caused this war rather than the man who'd tried to stop it. But I think our desire to have heroes, to have father figures, paternal figures in following cults, our adoption of belief systems where we are willing to suspend our intelligence and just take things on. And that authoritarian thing, the idea of, well, I don't know well enough to make a decision, so I'll vote for this man who says he's certain. And, you know, he can be the divine emissary who will tell me what to do. I think those attitudes, as they run through our culture, I don't think there is an inevitability that power will corrupt. As Acton said, tends to corrupt. And occasionally there are people who are able to rise above that. Again, as Churchill said, and I'm not a huge fan of Winston Churchill, but democracy is a terrible system, but it's better than all the others. And if we were able to refine democracy so that we actually could make decisions and were well-informed enough to make decisions, we could perhaps move forward. And I have a belief in that. I have a belief that we are getting better in some ways as a society. If I look to Victorian society and, you know, putting four-year-olds up chimneys and down mines, you know, since then we've had the water babies and we've changed our attitude towards children in the Western world. We're still not stopping child, you know, slavery. There are more slaves in the world now than there have ever been, somewhere around 40 million, most of them in India. And yet where we stopped trading with South Africa because of apartheid, we allow trade with a country that has a caste system with 2,000 little compartments in it and actively has slavery and, of course, no universal education, all sorts of things. How, you know, and I'm not asking you, this is a rhetorical question. How do we, you know, because we might be here for a very long time. How do we solve those problems? How do we make something different? And by believing in goodness, whether we believe it in it as, you know, personified by God or simply as a virtue, simply as, you know, which is its own punishment, of course, that I do believe that we stand at a transformative stage in humanity. But we have to understand certain things, and, you know, we have to only be intolerant of intolerance, as Isaiah Berlin put it. And so therefore the ecumenical work you've been doing and continue to do becomes incredibly important, looking at the way that the churches in the past, you know, that Innocent II decided, decided he was going to wipe out the Albigensians, the Cathars, the first genocide of the Catholic Church, or the arguments between the Eastern and Western churches, all of this, which seems to have so little to do with the Christian message and the idea of unity within the body of Christ, within the church.
No, I agree with that. It is deeply tragic, but very human, that we've done so many things which are actually contrary to the gospel, contrary to what we were supposed to be doing. And I remember the change in my own lifetime. When I was a child, if you managed to put down a member of another church, that was considered to be a good thing. make them feel bad about their own church or whatever. And that's just contrary to the gospel. It's where there's no love one another as I have loved you present in that. And I believe very strongly, as you were saying, about the, you call it the belief in goodness, and that would do me fine as a way of talking about it. I mean, I believe in love, which is, seems to me to, that's what goodness is ultimately about. So that struggle.
Love is the belief in goodness, really, perhaps.
I think so. Yeah. No, I think that's the coterminous, really. And so, for example, just to illustrate, this builds up on what you were saying, really. When Israel invaded Gaza, I felt horrible and I felt impotent. And I thought, what can I do? And I thought, well, I can pray. That didn't seem to me to be enough. So what can I do? And I thought about it, and I thought about all of the awful things that are going on in the world. And frankly, the world seems to me at this stage, and it's not just because I'm an older person. We're moving, as it were, downwards at the moment. The world goes through these ups and downs. Most of my life has been fairly up. but now the rise of right-wing populism and all that sort of stuff, it seems to me it lives in a fantasy world of, make whatever nation it is you want to talk about great again. So that we'd all have tried to be top nation without anyway seeing that this is bound to lead to conflict. It seems to be a no-brainer. But anyway, it struck me that the kind of the mentality that was going on in all of these sorts of things was the mentality of might and of strength and of might making right. And it presents itself as being realistic. So I make you not a threat to me by wiping you out or taking your weapons off you or whatever. That seems like it's realistic. The trouble is, it never works. As we all know, violence just breeds more violence. And the only way that ends, if it's going to end, is when everybody's exhausted or mostly dead. That's kind of the mentality. So, but we could, or I think we need an alternative mentality. So what mentality is it? And it seems to me the mentality genuinely of love, the struggle to listen, it's a struggle to serve, the struggle to put the other's interests in the first place. These are not easy things to do at all. They're very difficult. But it's only by having that kind of an approach that we truly disarm the other. And that we will not just disarm the other, but we'll have a true meeting with the other, where we change the relationship. So, yes, humanism is part of that bigger picture. And that's what I understand. It comes directly from sort of from the Gospels, from Jesus's stuff about the kingdom of God. It's about a new world lived among us. And the dynamic of it is this dynamic of love. So I would say that seems to me to be way more realistic than the other thing that is often peddled in the world or put forward in the world, probably better to put it, as being the realistic solution.
Yeah, if we exterminate humanity, then we will have peace.
Absolutely.
And so much mythology, the idea of a nation. What is a nation? I had a friend a few years ago, and he was telling me how patriotic he is. So he went and looked the word up. And he hadn't realized that this meant that he was willing to lay down his life for his fellow Americans. And it was like, but of course, you don't mean Latinos, do you? Because you want to build a wall and stop them from coming in. And you don't mean Democrats because you're a Republican, and you, so on and so forth, that this way of joining ourselves to an ideology rather than it's sort of where Snowden releases all of this information, which was of course quite dangerous to some of the people who were working for the espionage system, but that his oath was to serve the American people, not the American government. not the American military, but to serve the American people. And by pointing out that he'd created backdoors that were ways of getting into foreign systems, you know, so Chancellor Merkel's phone was being bugged by the Americans. That was one of the classic things, which Obama just brushed off with a joke, which surprised me. Oh, yeah, we spy on our friends for their own good, you know. Well, that doesn't sound very healthy to me. But Snowden had actually been the guy who'd helped make this system and been promised they wouldn't use it. And that was the point for him. But that thing of, do we serve humanity or do we serve the interests of a state or of a group? And I think it has always seemed to me rather evident that if we do not consider the rest of humanity valuable, then we are going to kill each other. We aren't going to have the proper respect. And of course, for most people in the world, this is such an academic conversation because they are just fighting to survive. They're fighting to have enough to eat in Africa and in the Pacific Rim. Wow. Yes. I can see the starting point for 1,000 conversations. I really can. But we'd probably better not belabor our audience any further. Let me just say that this is, to me, is fascinating. It is such a pleasure, you know, to spend time with you again these many years later, and hopefully we will carry on doing so. Do you have any last words that you would like to share with me or with the audience?
Well, I think the one thing I would like to say is that. That possibility of relationships of love is certainly a political thing. So that whenever I generate a mentality of love by doing an act of love, I'm actually doing a political act.
Yes.
I want to say also that it's laying the grounds for a profound experience of God. And that's been part of the core of my own experience. Whatever language you wish to use, we open ourselves up to the transcendent when those relationships become mutual. And I think that's an amazing possibility because it's not only about us getting on well with one another, although it is profoundly about that too, but it's about opening ourselves up to things that are wonderful and great and beautiful. So that's where it is for me, let's say.
Wonderful.
Very well.
Tremendous pleasure. Let's get together again in the future and do some more of this, choose some more fabs. Thank you so much, Callum.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you'd click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.